Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Sepurl Sequoia against Carlson Company. Ms. Stadler.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Catherine Stadler of the law firm of Godfrey & Kahn. I'm here today representing the plaintiff appellant, Sepurl Sequoia Limited. I would like to thank the panel for taking the time to hear argument in this case. The question for the court today is a simple but important one. May the district court enter summary judgment concluding that one party to a contract breached that contract in the face of disputed issues of fact surrounding the nature of the contract itself?
There's actually, counsel, an antecedent question which concerns subject matter jurisdiction. You describe the plaintiff as Sepurl Sequoia Limited. What is an entity with an LTD in its name under Hong Kong law?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Your brief describes Sepurl Sequoia as a corporation.
Correct.
And what does that mean under Hong Kong law?
Well, let me take a look at my jurisdictional statement.
Your jurisdictional statement doesn't answer this question. I can tell you the little research says that in Hong Kong, one uses the abbreviation LTD to refer to two kinds of entities. One we would refer to in the United States as a corporation, and the other we would refer to in the United States as a limited partnership. Which kind is Sepurl Sequoia?
I don't know the answer to that question. I believe it
Please
is a corporation.
Not touch the microphone.
Sorry. I believe it is a corporation, sir.
And what is the basis for that belief?
Representations that my
have
client has made.
Sepurl Sequoia's own website?
I have.
Have you noticed that it describes itself as a partnership rather than as a corporation?
I have not noticed that, no.
Sepurl Sequoia not only describes itself as a partnership, but it names its two partners. One of them is another Hong Kong LTD, without further explanation, and the other is an American limited liability company. Well, if Sepurl Sequoia is a partnership, we need to know the names of all of its partners. And if one of its partners is an LLC, we need to know the names and citizenships of every member of the LLC. So where do we go from here?
Well, my proposal would be one of two things, to set a schedule for the submission of additional materials responsive to those questions, and if Your Honor would like briefing on the jurisdictional issue that you have just raised, I would be happy to do that and adjourn, allowing us some time to do that, or we could make that arrangement to do that jurisdictional briefing and proceed today on the arguments on the merits that were argued and briefed by the parties.
We're not going to argue the case today. There's never going to be any other argument in this case.
Okay.
Why are you... I'm puzzled. We have a Hong Kong LTD, certainly not something people are used to dealing with. Isn't this something that you would want to have done some legal research on? Please do not touch the microphone.
Your Honor, I did the jurisdictional research based on the materials filed in the district court by my client and its prior counsel. We relied upon the district court's finding of subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction, and as appellate counsel, I can honestly represent to you in earnest that it did not occur to us to research jurisdictional issues that hadn't been raised or challenged either by the parties in the district court or by the district court itself.
The fact that jurisdiction is not challenged in the district court is not relevant. We have a duty to assure ourselves of jurisdiction, as do you. It's one reason why we have our jurisdictional briefing rule. There's one other jurisdictional question in this case, which is, what happens if Sepurl Sequoia has members that are citizens of Hong Kong and members that are citizens of the United States? Can it take advantage of the alienage jurisdiction?
I don't know the answer to that today, Judge, but I would be happy to submit supplemental briefing on that and all other jurisdictional questions.
Okay. Well, please proceed.
As I was saying, the question, as we understood it for the court today, setting aside the jurisdictional questions that I understand we may be ordered to brief, is whether the circuit court or the district court can enter a summary judgment on the meaning of a party's contract and the breach of that contract as a matter of law in the face of disputed issues of material fact regarding the intention of the parties to the contract. So Pearl contends that the district court entered summary judgment in the face of disputed material facts about the meaning of the party's agreement. That judgment must be reversed and the matter remanded for a new trial. At summary judgment, Gary Dumbart, Sue Pearl's agent in the United States, testified that he provided a fixed price quote to Carlson in February of 2007.
When was the contract entered into?
It's a really good question, Your Honor. The parties, as you know, had to provide bidding to Federated Department Stores, which we're shorthanding as Macy's, in the late days of February 2007. They had initial conversations about pricing and their ability to provide products under Federated's requirements prior to that auction, but no written documentation purporting to be an agreement or a contract was issued until later in April and May. And in fact, the district court found that it was an email in May, on May 7th of 2007, that constituted the party's written agreement. Our client asserts that the party's contract actually occurred in part when it provided a cost pricing estimate to Carlson that Carlson could then use as a fixed price, quote, to turn around and bid the project to Federated.
And when is that exactly?
That was in early February 2007. The exact figures for the price quotation were a bit of a moving target, Judge, because at the early stages, the number of fixtures to be required was in flux. So what Superl did was provided Carlson with pricing per fixture based on its internal investigation and seeking of price quotes from other suppliers, and offered Carlson a price that it believed it could provide the fixtures at. The ultimate contract price that Superl proceeded as having an understanding that it would be paid was based on the final number of fixtures, which was somewhere in the 4,000 range, 4,000 and maybe a couple of extra. But the initial understanding of Superl was that the price that it quoted to Carlson at the outset in the early part of February, which Carlson then turned around and added markup to, added its own cost to, and used as a basis for its bid to Federated and Macy's, was the contract price, and that the subsequent May email agreement was an email agreement that did a couple of things. One, define the terms of the party's business dealings beyond the Martha Stewart project. And two, put a finer point on timing and payments and how invoices and purchase orders and those sorts of things would go back and forth so that Superl wasn't stuck waiting for a $3 million check at the end of the entire shipping process.
So when was the meeting of the minds then that formed the contract?
The meeting of the minds happened in early February when Carlson accepted Superl's price quote.
So you're basically saying that Judge Crabb was wrong when she said that the contract was this May 17th or May 18th, whatever it is, document.
May 8th, I think 7th, actually, yes. Yes, that's what we're saying. I don't think she was wrong to use the contents of the May 7th email to inform her interpretation of the party's intent at the outset.
Now I'm lost, because I thought when I read your brief that your position was there were two contracts. One was the contract for the sale of these particular fixtures for $3.4 million or so as a fixed price, and the other was an additional contract for other business dealings or supplemental division of the profits here But your answer to Judge Connelly's question is that the May 7th thing was not a contract at all?
Well, it's a good question. If you think about a contract being offer, acceptance, and consideration, I would say yes, that May 7th agreement standing alone would not have constituted a contract in and of itself. It can't be viewed outside the context of the earlier discussion of the consideration for the contract.
Now I'm utterly lost on your thinking about what constitutes a contract. If you and I say that I will sell you my car and you'll give me $10,000, that can't be viewed outside the context of the fact that we're speaking English, we have certain understandings of what a car is, and so on. Surely you don't mean that whenever you have to look outside a document to understand its context, it can't be a contract.
No, certainly not. No.
But other than that, why is the May 6th exchange not a contract?
Because it doesn't include a discussion of the price. The price had been established earlier in February. In your hypothetical,
the May document says the parties are going to bill each other based on cost, right? If the Army contracts for a howitzer and it's on a cost-plus contract, that's surely a contract, even though it doesn't say how much the Army is going to pay.
I would agree with you, unless the parties to the agreement, including the Army, had agreed on a cost ahead of time.
It seems to me you're biting off more than you need to here. Any part of your position turn on denying that the May document is a contract?
No. Our position is that putting together the initial discussions of price.
Again, as I thought from your brief, that you were saying that the actual bid and acceptance counted as the cost for the purpose of this deal under the May 7th contract.
That's correct.
You weren't saying it's not a contract and we don't have any other dealings.
That's correct.
If there were a profit, right? Carlson pays the $3.4 million. It does what it does. It makes a profit. It's your client's position that your client's entitled to 50% of that profit, is it not?
Correct.
On the basis of the May contract. And that depends on that being a contract, right?
Yes. Yes, that's
right.
Correct.
So your position now is that it is, in fact, a contract.
I still don't believe that the May 8 agreement standing alone constitutes a contract.
Well, then you have to say your client's not entitled to any part of the profit, and so on.
Well, frankly, Judge, I think if my client were to be awarded the contract price, that might not be an entirely untenable result for us. But
I'm not asking you what is the best outcome for you. We really need to figure out such things as, is that a contract? And I continue to be puzzled by what seems to me a complete contradiction of a position taken in your brief. And maybe I've just totally misunderstood your brief.
Well, I can't answer that question for you, but what I can tell you is the argument that we asserted on summary judgment and then the arguments that we subsequently made on trial based on the court's
ruling. The arguments
you
made on summary judgment and at trial are not here in the Seventh Circuit. What is here is your brief.
Correct. I'd like to back up a little bit. I don't think that there is a dispute between the parties as to whether they had the contract for the provision of goods and fixtures to satisfy a joint obligation to Federated. I don't think there is a dispute between the parties as to whether the May 7th agreement constituted part of that agreement to provide fixtures. There is a dispute between the parties about whether only the May 7th agreement governed or whether the prior discussions of price and quoted costs were incorporated within that May 7th agreement. Indeed, there's a binding contract. If I have said something to lead the court to believe that we're asserting there is no contract here, I have gravely misspoken. We are seeking to enforce contractual rights. My point was merely to reinforce that the party's contract and a key provision of that contract, which was what would Sapearl be paid under the contract was established at the very outset of the agreement, at the very outset of the relationship, when Sapearl provided a price quote to Carlson that Carlson then incorporated in its bid to Macy's. All of that predated May 7th, and that alone is the reason for my qualification of the inquiries from the bench on that point.
What you just said is closer to the way I understood your brief. What I understood you to be arguing is that taking is a given that the May email was a contract, that the district judge erred in concluding that cost meant no profit, and that your view was that cost meant the cost that had been agreed upon at this earlier point in time, which included this markup for contingencies or whatever it was. Is that closer to what you're saying?
Yes, it is. I regret that I was unable to articulate it that way.
Okay, so when Judge Crabb interpreted the contract, this is one of the things that's a little bit unclear to me about her decision. Did she interpret the email from within its four corners, if you will, or did she refer to other things? And what exactly did she do?
She referred to other things. In her decision, she quoted the rule that if a contract is ambiguous, you can look outside the contract. And although she never explicitly said, this contract is ambiguous, so I'm going to look outside of it, or outside of its four corners, she cited Black's Law Dictionary, for example, for the definition of profits. She referred to the party's course of dealings and other arrangements that they had had. And she made statements like, no reasonable meaning of this term based on the party's actions and conduct could be read in such a way. So she clearly went beyond the four corners of the May 7th agreement to look to the party's meaning in that document. And frankly, Judge, I don't have an issue with Judge Crabb's decision to find that agreement ambiguous and to look outside of its terms for intention of the parties.
You're basically just saying she didn't look far enough and she should have considered testimony or whatever.
She didn't look far enough, and she didn't look in the proper summary judgment standard. On summary judgment, her obligation was to make inferences in opposition to the moving party, which was Carlson, and she had before her two witnesses saying two different things. Gary Dembart said, I quoted a price that included some contingency markup, and Carlson's witnesses were saying, we didn't know that. And Gary Dembart said, they never asked me. There was clearly conflicting testimony on that point, and the standard, as the court well knows on summary judgment, is whether there is an absence of disputed issues of fact with reasonable inferences being made against the moving party, which was Carlson. So our argument with the district court's summary judgment methodology is not that she implicitly found the contract ambiguous and looked outside of it for the party's intent, but that she ignored the disputed issue of fact that was so clearly presented in the record before her in concluding, one, that the agreement meant cost can't include profit, and two, that by including some measure of markup in the February price quote, that Sapearl had breached that agreement. I'd like to take a moment to talk about the damages phase of this trial, because at the end of the day, with the breach and the meaning of the contract determined as a matter of law on summary judgment, the trial, which spanned about a week, focused solely on the issue of timing of shipments and damages. Judge Crabb, having predetermined the existence of the breach, shaped the testimony that was presented in court. And her rulings were all designed to allocate, based on her interpretation of the contract and the party's intent with respect to splitting profits and expenses. She sought to divide the kitty, so to speak, among the two parties. When she did that, she adjusted her prior ruling about the meaning of the word cost. And in doing so, she applied a different standard of the term cost to Carlson for purposes of damages calculations than she applied to Sapearl at the summary judgment stage. So compounding the legal error of entering summary judgment in the meaning of the contract and breach in the first place, she then changed the contractual definition that she had established in summary judgment when she allowed Carlson to include markup and costs that were outside actual expenditures of Carlson to cover the contract and perform under the contract. She also, unfortunately, shifted the contractual burdens of proof and did not require Carlson to prove up all elements of its contractual damages under the UCC. I see my light is on. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve my time.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you very much. Ms. Brooks.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Amy Brooks. I represent the Carlson Company. May it please the court, in addition to answering any questions that the court has, I would like to make 3 points during my presentation, the first of which addresses the contract issue, which you've been discussing.
The first question has to do with subject matter jurisdiction. Where are we on subject matter jurisdiction?
Judge, in Sepurl Sequoia's complaint, it alleged that it was a foreign corporation.
It may have alleged that. What did you do to check whether that's true?
Well, we ran into barriers in the course of discovery trying to determine the true nature of the organization.
Why do you need discovery? Hong Kong has a public registry. Anybody can find out the complete nature and investors in Sepurl Sequoia Limited by consulting Hong Kong's the company's registry. It's online. You have to pay a fee, but the way to find out what Sepurl Sequoia is to just consult its public registry in Hong Kong and pay their fee.
Yes, Judge, and we didn't do so.
You didn't do that. Did you do legal research on what LTD means in Hong Kong law?
No, Judge, we didn't.
Look at their website and see their statement that they are a partnership rather than a corporation.
We absolutely did, and we named actually both parties to that part in to that on that website in our counterclaim.
Now I'm utterly baffled because Ms. Stadler says it comes as a revelation to her that the website says that Sepurl Sequoia is a partnership, although Sepurl Sequoia is her client. You say that that's been raised in this litigation. Why have the two of you decided to keep us in the dark until we raise this ourselves?
Judge, respectfully, because the Carlson company had claims against either the United States partnership or against the SSL, the foreign corporation, we were pleased that that Sepurl had availed itself to the jurisdiction of the district court.
I don't give a fig whether you're pleased to be in federal court. We have a duty to determine whether federal jurisdiction exists, and the fact that the parties like it and decide to pull the wool over the eyes of the judges is no excuse. You have a professional obligation to alert us to any legitimate questions, and I now gather that you had legitimate questions, you concluded from their website that their allegation that they were a corporation is actually false, or at least it's inconsistent with what their website says, and you decided to hide that from us.
No, Judge, if I may. We named both parties, asserting that the website indicated it was either a partnership or that both parties should be named in this lawsuit. And then on deposition, the Gary Dembart and others, agents of Sepurl Sequoia, denied having any actual partnership and instead indicated that the website was puffery designed to sell to customers so that they would be left with the understanding that there was a local arm in the partnership.
So basically that the LLC didn't exist? I mean, is that what you're saying? In other words, the second company that you named in your counterclaim was the Sequoia Group Holdings LLC, right?
That's correct.
And so you're saying Mr. Dembert testified that didn't exist?
No, he testified that he and his partner, Mark Roberts, had incorporated that, but they technically had no legal relationship other than a general agency to the Hong Kong entity. Correct.
So what ended up happening with the LLC on the counterclaim? Did they get dropped out, or what exactly?
There was a motion to dismiss based on the economic loss doctrine that was filed.
Okay.
And so the district court dismissed the LLC.
Did you ever find out what the citizenship of the members of the LLC was?
Yes. In discovery, they were alleged to be Gary Denbart and Mark Roberts, both of whom are United States, individuals in the United States.
But what state of the
United
States?
What state?
I'm sorry, Judge. It's an East Coast state. No, definitely not Wisconsin.
Denbart, and who was the second guy?
Mark Roberts.
Okay.
Were there any lawyers involved in the negotiation of this contract?
No, there were not.
Didn't look like
it. I understand. With regard to the contract, throughout the course of this case, at least up until the reply brief, Sapril argued that Trial Exhibit 85, the May 7th, 9:08 p.m. email, was the agreement governing the Martha Stewart project. Sapril has now completely shifted that theory, or at least it did so in its reply brief, arguing in its brief that the May 7th email does not apply to the Martha Stewart project at all. In answering the judge's question as to when a contract was formed, it was formed during the course of discussions between Mr. Carlson and Mr. Denbart between February and May when the agreement was memorialized. There are actually three versions of that May 7th email, two on May 7th and one on May 8th. And in the first May 7th email, which is Trial Exhibit 84, Mr. Carlson wrote Gary Denbart, "Here's my understanding of what we've discussed weeks ago regarding Martha." And Denbart, in response to that, wrote, "Okay." Then Carlson wrote that, back to Martha specifically, "But what we may also use for other jobs, we share quoted costs, not sell price, but costs." And Denbart wrote, agreed. Then on summary judgment, Sapril actually argued that the May 7th agreement was the memorialization of the terms of the contract. And it said the parties memorialized their agreement subsequently in separate emails containing the conspicuous label Carlson Company and Sapril Sequoia Guiding Agreement. That's from page 2 of their summary judgment brief. And the May 7th email contains that label.
So what you're saying is that when the case was in the district court, Sapril never took the position that the May 7th email only related to other deals.
That's exactly correct.
Okay.
And so the district court interpreted the May 7th email. And so the primary argument that Sapril is now making is completely rebutted. They waived that argument, and it just does not reflect the documents in this case. The second point I would like to address is that Sapril is now trying to distance itself from the May 7th agreement because either on a plain language basis or based on the intent of the parties, Sapril breached that agreement. The district court analyzed the contract on both levels. First on the plain language, and then on the intent of the parties as shown in contemporaneous documents. And both of those analyses lead to the conclusions that the parties only intended for the cost to have a cost contract, not a sell price. The May 7th agreement says it's not sell price, it's not markup, and it's not overhead. It's only
cost. What happens under the May 7th agreement if Sapril experienced unexpectedly high costs in fulfilling this contract? Say, if it cost them $5 million to make and ship these fixtures.
They were bound by their cost provision. The only exception in the May 7th agreement.
If the May 7th contract is controlling, and requires only cost, then it displaces this $3.4 million bid. What you've just said amounts to saying we get the benefits of the $3.4 million bid, but not the detriment. And that can't be right. Either it's displaced or it isn't.
It's displaced, Judge.
I don't understand your answer to my question. If Sapearl had said our costs of fulfilling this contract were $5 million, doesn't it follow that it's entitled to $5
million? No, because of other provisions in the May 7th agreement. The May 7th agreement doesn't say that costs will be reimbursed to the parties. It says quoted costs, which has a time component in it. And the May 7th agreement says that when there is a quoted cost, not a sell price, but a cost, then the parties have a pre-agreed manufacturing cost that will be paid. And the contract also goes on to state that production errors, engineering errors.
I'm still puzzled. I can see how one could say, which is Sapearl's position, that the $3.4 million quote was, under the May 7th agreement, defined as the cost. What I'm trying to explore now is how there could be an asymmetry here in which Carlson gets the benefit if Sapearl's actual cost is less than $3.4 million. But it doesn't have to pay an additional penny if Sapearl's actual cost is greater than $3.4 million. Where does the asymmetry in your answer come from?
It's because there's two parts to that answer. Number one, throughout discovery and at trial, Carlson tried to determine what the actual cost would have been but for production.
Discovery and trial won't help us understand the meaning of this contract. Where does the asymmetry come from in the contractual language?
The asymmetry comes from the inclusion of the word quoted in the cost. Quoted and cost. It can't be sell price because, Judge, if Sapearl would have not withheld that fact or had negotiated an agreement which would say it was adding profit in at the front end of the deal, Carlson could have gone elsewhere for the goods.
You're not. Maybe my question is not sufficiently clear. What you want to do is treat the May 7th agreement as an agreement to sell at cost and then divide the profits. That kind of agreement exists in the world only when the cost can go up or down. No sane person negotiates an agreement that says, if our costs are lower than our quoted price, we'll sell it at cost. If our costs are higher than our quoted price, we'll sell it at our quoted price. That kind of asymmetric agreement is prima facie evidence of insanity, right? You say that this contract has that kind of asymmetric agreement in it, and that seems to be very hard to get to. Either it's costs all the way or it's quoted price all the way, but it's very hard to see this mixture. And I'm trying to figure out where that comes from on your view in this agreement.
And I apologize if I'm not following you, Judge. The agreement says that once there's a quoted cost, and it is made up only of a cost component, not price, not profit, not markup, then if the party benefits by saving money and coming in below the cost, it gets the benefit of that deal. But if it goes over the cost, either because of omissions or errors, then it's still bound to the cost.
I understand that that's your answer. You just haven't pointed to any language in the agreement supporting that answer.
There was testimony, Judge, at trial.
Testimony is not language in the agreement.
The agreement is, in several instances, indicates that the quoted cost that would be shared would not include overhead or markup. And so the agreement states that that is the price that will be paid, without regard to whether it goes over or under.
Then your answer has to be that if their costs were really $5 million, they're entitled to $5 million.
No, Judge, because that would exclude the component, the time component of the quoted cost piece, because they're obligated to provide the cost up front in a quoted cost format, and then the agreement says that's the pre-agreed manufacturing cost. And then they're not entitled to recover under paragraph 11 of the agreement any additional costs that result from leaving things out of the quote, from production errors, from engineering errors, or the like.
One other question about your position. Are you contending, I want to move away from this, what is their cost, to the question of what is your client's cost. Your client contended that its cost included of making repairs and so on for Macy's benefit, included the price that it normally charged to outside customers. It were the price it normally charged to outside customers.
Yes.
That's the normal measure in a lost volume case, because if your client has to turn away other paying customers in order to fix this, then its opportunity cost is what it could have charged the other customers. Did you allege and prove at trial that your client was in a lost volume position?
Judge, at trial, we did present testimony that the number of orders that Carlson Company processed and the number of projects it was able to take on in 2007 dropped significantly, and Carlson's witnesses testified that that was because both, number one, Carlson was not out hunting down business, and that Carlson was so busy with these fixes, it was not able to take on any additional business. And that is in the docket entry at 101, pages 13 and 14, in the testimony of Peter Hennigan.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The courts asked a question earlier of Ms. Stadler as to what contemporaneous document showed that Sapperl knew it could not add markup to its quoted costs. And the best example of that, such a contemporaneous document is, and there are others, but it's there's a May 16th email from Gary Dembart, and that was also submitted to the district court at the summary judgment stage. That's in docket entry 19 at Exhibit B. And there, Gary Dembart stated that the Martha Stewart arrangement is correct. We split the cost of manufacturing 50-50 and the profit 50-50. And because of that contemporaneous document, the district court concluded that at the time of contracting, Sapperl would breach the agreement because it would be recovering more than 50% of the profits overall if it built profit in the front end. The third point I would like to raise relates to damages. At summary judgment, Sapperl did not even respond to Carlson's argument that with respect to those fixtures that were defective, they breached an implied warranty of merchantability. This is important because now Sapperl is arguing that Carlson didn't carry its burden of proof with that regard, claiming that somehow Carlson's standards were higher than Macy's standards or the like. At summary and so the district court ruled against Sapperl at the summary judgment stage on that basis because it considered them to have waived the argument. Hence, a large portion of Sapperl's current briefs on appeal are irrelevant or at least waived because SSL never argued at the summary judgment stage that the repairs were either unnecessary or not according to Macy's standards. Sapperl also argues that the fixtures were defective with regard to the fixtures being defective under Carlson standards and not Macy's standards. There are three reasons why that's not a valid argument. Number one, again, at summary judgment, Sapperl did not raise that argument. Number two, Carlson was the customer here, not Macy's. And number three, Carlson presented the testimony of Macy's witnesses, who indicated that they would have rejected the pictures that they reviewed before Carlson fixed them because they were defective under Macy's standards. And the deposition summaries of Lisa Werner and Brian Ford both state that fact. They were submitted to the district court. The last issue I would like to briefly address is Carlson's measure of damages, and that is that because of the unique nature of the fixes and the goods in this case, we would assert that the cost of repair is a reasonable measure of damages. Carlson fixed these fixtures at breakneck speed in order to not end up in even more trouble with Macy's. It mitigated its damages and afterwards equated the difference in the value between the goods it received versus the goods it bargained for as being equal to what any company in the industry would have charged in order to fix these fixtures. And Carlson proved to the satisfaction of the district court that the amount it sought as damages were charged under commercially reasonable rates. I see that my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Stadler, we took a lot of your time with questions, so I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. I appreciate that. The question of who was the customer and who was the client in this situation is not in dispute. Superl agrees that Carlson was its customer. But the breach of contract and the trial to determine the damages awarded for that breach was inquiring about the question of merchantability. And the question of merchantability cannot be decided without looking to the standards of the ultimate customer, Macy's. So the issue, the refrain that Carlson is the customer and therefore it should be able to unilaterally impose standards on the goods it received ignores the fact that the entire purpose of this contract, which is not in dispute, was to deliver product to the Macy's chain of department stores. The trial that took place did not hold Carlson to the burden of proof to prove that its products that it received did not reach the level of merchantability necessary to meet Macy's requirements. Carlson's attorney has made a point that Superl has waived its arguments about damages for breach because we didn't dispute the breach of the warranty of merchantability at summary judgment. Superl, at every stage of this litigation and prior to the litigation, acknowledged that some products, especially those that were air freighted, would arrive in defective and damaged condition and would require repair. And Superl, at every stage of this relationship, stood ready to acknowledge those deficiencies and either fix them itself or allow Carlson to fix them. The question is not whether there was a breach, but what were Carlson's provable damages for that breach? And for the reasons Judge Crabb outlined, the time constraints and everyone was rushing and it was the holidays and the employees were upset, the records weren't kept, or if they were kept, they certainly weren't produced. Thank you.
Now, the court invites counsel for both sides to file supplemental memoranda on the question of subject matter jurisdiction. It seems to me that there are three logical questions here, and we hope you will address all three. The first is what kind of entity, in particular, is Superl Sequoia? The best way to answer that question is to get us an English translation of its memorandum of association. I expect it probably exists originally in both Chinese and English. It can be got from the Hong Kong Companies Registry over the Internet. You just have to pay their fee. So a copy of their memorandum of association would be a big step. If the second question is that if it is the kind of entity that in Hong Kong law is referred to as limited by guarantee rather than limited by shares, who are all of its members? And that has to be traced through all of its levels. The final question, if it turns out that it has any member who is not a citizen of a foreign nation, we need to know as a legal matter what happens under Section 1332 to the alienage jurisdiction when a litigant has dual citizenship in the sense of being both a citizen of a foreign nation and a citizen of a state of the United States. So we will give you 2 weeks for a memoranda on those issues, and we look forward to receiving them. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.